Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. Hello, love.
Hello, Don.
How was your week?
Let's see. Not bad, actually, for me, health-wise. This week hasn't been too bad. I'm recovering from whatever illness I had. I'm still not sleeping very well. I had some blood work done, which shows I'm really low in iron. So hopefully I'll get an iron transfusion on the NHS because it's that bad, which would account for all my hair falling out and various other symptoms like restless legs and all those kind of things that you get, palpitations with the iron, low iron.
Even the palpitations and things, that's the thing. And it's shocking, really, that no one's taken this more seriously in you until now.
As we know, it's really arbitrary whether the low iron is taken seriously or not. If you're just borderline or the low end, the GP will say, no, you're fine.
But that's also the thing, isn't it? It's done on the hemoglobin, whereas if your hemoglobin's okay, but your iron's through the floor, as Dr. Klein explained,
Yeah. You've
got all the symptoms. That's the crazy thing about you. You've had all the symptoms. You've got a huge blood loss. But I'm not a doctor, Noreen, so...
You're my doctor. apart from that, you know, I have to say, though, both my kids are having really bad post-viral illnesses after getting glandular fever. And it's been quite shocking to see how post-viral, because we know what to look out for now, don't we?
Yeah.
So my daughter's now being tested for lupus, waiting on the blood work for that.
Right.
Got all the classic signs. And my son, who was hospitalised with the mono, 2 months ago, has now come out in a complete full body rash that none of the doctors can explain. It looks exactly like measles. But it's been 8 weeks since he was hospitalised and 8 weeks since he had any kind of medication.
It's quite an interesting area, isn't it? Because I wonder what the instances of other post-viral illnesses are post-COVID. And whether your children, had we not had the COVID, would have reacted to glandular fever in this way. I don't know. I don't know that we have stats on that because I don't know how you can separate it all out.
No, and I think we're only aware of it because, you know, we're deep into the science of it. But would I have put two and two together? My son's rash and, you know, his very acute viral illness 2 months ago? Probably not. Would I have put EBV in my daughter 8 months ago now down to her potential lupus diagnosis with the band-aid across her face, rash and joint pain and hair loss? Probably not. Anecdotally, doctors are telling me that this is really prevalent in children right now, post-viral weird diseases.
Yeah, because our immune systems have taken such a hit, haven't they?
Yeah.
And it's really awful when you think about it being the kids who have been affected that way, because this is their immune system for the rest of their lives. And we now need to work out how we can reverse this damage.
Yes. And how was your week, my love?
Well, so since we last recorded, I have had some great times. I've been skiing. I've done a birthday, not my birthday, my son's birthday. And I've been surfing. And then in between each of those, I have horrendous crashes. So right now, I'm really, really not good. I've had the kids for 3.5 weeks. This is day three of a pretty nasty crash. So I'm really not great. As I always say, it's the mental impact of it that is the worst, because, you know, I always tell you that I'm recovered. And each time I go and do any of these things and feel properly alive and feel great, and I say I'm not going to crash this time because I'm better, I'm recovered, look at the things that I can do, and then I go into a crash.
Just by looking at you, I can tell you're a little bit shaky.
Yeah, I'm in pain. Everything hurts. Everything hurts. I'm so shattered. My heart even hurts. I just had to walk the dog, and I'll walk about 300 meters. When I'm in the crashes, walk about 300 meters and I lose all of the blood in three toes on my left foot. They go white. I've taken a photo for you, Noreen.
That's fabulous.
So I don't know. I definitely feel better when I take aspirin. And so I don't know if there's some kind of coagulation that causes the toe situation. I have also seen a cardiologist since we last spoke, and I am actually being sent for a whole load of tests.
Oh, wow. Which ones?
I'm having a lung function test, a stress echo, a VQ lung scan, and a PET scan of my entire body from my neck to my knees, which I thanked the cardiologist very much for organizing this for me. But I did say that I really, really would like, if anyone out there can do it for me, I would like to see a neurologist and have some kind of scan of my head, given that neurological symptoms have been my most prominent ones. I'm still waiting for that neurology referral from my GP. It's been submitted. I've not heard anything back. It was submitted around 4 months ago. 4 years I've had this, and I've not been able to get an appointment with a neurologist on the NHS.
Wow. Well, I'm slightly jealous. I don't think I've had a PET scan or a VQ.
4 years in, someone's decided to look at my body.
That's awesome. What's he looking for in the PET scan for the full body inflammation?
So I think they need to do an MRI of the heart or lungs. But because I had such an adverse reaction to my prior MRI, he can't do it without the dye. And so it's just a different way of doing the scan. But because you're in the scanner, you get the whole of your body, basically.
Well, that's really good. We see the same cardiologist. He's sending me for another MRI because I did tell him that my heart's feeling much better than it was 2 years ago.
Which is great news for everyone with heart pain, isn't it?
Yeah.
To know that it can get better.
Yeah, I've taken really very little medication in the last 2 years for it. So here we go. Let's see. Maybe this is it. This is our on the up.
Yeah, but you know I'm on the up every week. I'm great, Noreen. I'm great. Oh, I'm really shit.
Oh, dear. I've been kind of slightly shit. Do you know what I mean? It's just that a little bit more shit than what we consider just a normal shitness. I don't know if you have a shitometer.
Yeah, we need a shitometer.
Kind of our everyday shit, just living with long COVID. And then I've had that kind of 15% increase where I'm just not feeling 100%, and a lot of it's to do with my bad monthly cycle, which then puts me in a dip for a week or two, then I recover, then it puts me in another dip, and obviously my lack of iron. But I'm hoping that once those things get sorted out, I'll just go back to the regular shit days.
Yeah, so if anyone knows about this sort of multi-systemic illness, it is this week's guest, Dr. Nancy Klimas. She directs the Institute for Neuroimmune Medicine, which is at Nova Southeast University in Florida.
Surprising that so much good research is going on in Florida, considering the state. The Surgeon General is quite a famous anti-vaxxer.
Yeah.
What did you think of her? I mean, we've now spoken to so many doctors. I'm always interested in your take on the particular specialty, particular expertise, and general knowledge.
I thought she was great because she's this no-nonsense powerhouse of this knowledge base that has been built from HIV through all of the ME/CFS Gulf War Syndrome work that she's done, and now putting that into long COVID.
My field for the longest time has been what happens to people after something like a virus or a toxic event that affects the brain. So neurotoxic injuries or post-viral illnesses. And I have been in the field of ME/CFS forever. And well, not that long, but 1987, that's a long time. And I had the opportunity to develop a research institute that was completely focused on those things in 2011. So I started at Nova Southeastern University, this amazing research institute that has clinicians, basic scientists, computational biologists, all working together to try to find targets for therapy and then translate that into clinical care. So it's a very exciting group of people I work with. I represent an amazing team. I think we have 17 faculty members in our group. It's a big group. I think it's 50 or more of us all together doing research and clinical care in these areas. Since we were already doing ME/CFS all these many years, which is predominantly post-viral or post-toxic injury, and long COVID happened, it sort of felt like one of those destined moments where we were in place doing that thing and with a fair amount of expertise and then a population that was just like our ME population, desperately seeking knowledgeable care appeared. And so we've been trying to segue or include, if you would, long COVID into our research mission and our care mission.
Wow, there's already so many questions to ask just from that introduction. I know that the department is neuroimmune medicine. Are you initially coming at it from the point of view of a neurologist or an immunologist?
I'm a clinical immunologist. We have a lot of different types of expertise in our group, but our focus is in neuroinflammation. Well, actually, it's more than that because these diseases are far more complicated than that. But the basic of these diseases is immunology, inflammation, energy, oxidative stress and energy, and perfusion. So if you think about the brain as a place that needs blood flow, makes energy, needs to clean that mess up again when it's done making free radicals. And if it doesn't, it triggers an inflammatory response. Then that's sort of the space of most of the ME/CFS science, throwing in a little viral reactivation just to keep things confusing. So there's a lot to sort of unpack in these illnesses. And long COVID is just as complicated, just a touch more complicated maybe than ME. So we use these computational biologists to deal with the fact that it's so darn complicated. When you use a group of people that can deal with mass amount of data, just huge amounts of data, and make it fit together like the parts of a puzzle, basically using math to figure it all out. I mean, that's pretty kind of cool, isn't it? That they're using essentially math and then taking all these really complicated systems and figuring out the connections, the interactions, the time courses, and then providing to us perhaps very innovative ways to try to put it back together again.
It's really interesting that you just said that long COVID was more complicated than ME/CFS seems
in one major way. We're doing a big research study now that the CDC is funding to compare ME/CFS and long COVID. The results are not ready yet. But what you have in long COVID is instead of the original target, say you had Epstein-Barr virus, which is mononucleosis, right? And you had post-mono ME. Well, the target of that infection was the immune system, cells in the immune system. The target of COVID is your vascular wall, the ACE receptor, which just peppers the wall of the endothelium, which is your blood vessels. So if you can imagine that the inflammatory site of acute COVID, as it morphs into long COVID, is an inflammation of your blood vessels and other things, but your blood vessels. That makes it a little more complicated.
Is that now agreed upon by the majority of people in the field that that is the path by which COVID impacts the full system?
Well, we know that what did COVID bind to? What's the receptor that the virus ACE2. Binds to? The ACE2 receptor, right? So there you go. Where's the ACE2 receptor? Well, that's where the immune system's going to go. You know, excuse me, I have a virus hanging off this receptor target, right? And then the immune system goes after it. So the big question, it's not a question in acute COVID, whether or not the endothelium is involved. Why do you think you have all those microclots and all the, you know, the things that were killing people during the worst of it, but even are incredibly troublesome today? That's got an awful lot to do with a vasculature target for inflammation during the infection. So with long COVID, you're saying, okay, well, that was acute COVID. What's going on when it persists? What's happening there? And that is, of course, the million-dollar question and the one that a vast amount of research is going on to try to answer.
In terms of the research that you've done, in which direction do you think that we're heading towards the answer of that? Because I know that you have looked extensively at viral reactivation.
Right. Yeah. And I don't want to discount all the elements and why it's going to be as complicated as ME to try to put that little puzzle back together again. I always say it's sort of like a quilt. You look at it through one window and you flesh it out. And then someone else is looking at it through another window, and it's a completely different picture over there. But in fact, when you stand back, you put all the little pieces together, you're making a quilt, and there's actually a whole landscape that's starting to emerge from all this different research. So one of the mistakes a lot of people make early in the field, and this is early in the field for long COVID, is perceiving it as an either-or situation or a competition. And it's so not that. One of the ways we look at ME/CFS, and of course now long COVID, when you have a lot of interactive systems that communicate and are impacted by an illness, a good word to look at is homeostasis. So we think about what keeps a person healthy, what is well, what is healthy, what is the homeostatic networks keeping everybody healthy? And I had to give lectures like this, and I have a beautiful illustration. It looks like mountains and valleys. When you're in wellness, you're in this valley of homeostasis. If you have a cold or a flu, you get out of your happy space, your homeostatic niceness, and you start climbing up a mountain. But when you are over your infection, you drop back into the normal well. But if you're in the misfortunate space of not getting over the infection and dropping into the right well, if you climb the mountain and drop down the other side, now your homeostatic network that's holding you there is very stable. It's not moving. And it's unwell. It's a sick set point. So one might think of chronic illness in terms of homeostasis, any chronic illness, but this one and two, is what keeps a person in this sick space when wellness is really not very far away, but there's a mountain between wellness and chronic illness. So a lot of the math geeks that work with us are our amazing computational biologists. Their whole job is to try to figure out with their modeling systems how to climb the mountain, make someone need to move out of their stable spot and drop back into the right, correct, healthy, homeostatic wellness spot. So all the math that our guys are doing when they're doing these computational modeling things, they're saying, okay, I can describe what's wrong with you. I can figure out how these networks interact. That alone is amazing. If you're saying I can stand back from the big picture and tell you why the neuroendocrine system, the immune system, the dysautonomia, the autonomic nervous system, and all those things are in this pattern, and they're not disparate individual observations. They're so connected, right? They're so networked. And I can describe that. That alone is a big contribution to science. But if you can take that kind of information and model the illness and then find targetable points for treatment, then what these folks are doing, at least in our group and hopefully others, is doing in silico clinical trials. That means basically they're hitting random points in any direction, in any combination, in any time course, many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of clinical trials in a computer, and then coming back to us and saying, we could reset these networks. We could make this go back to normal or look a whole lot more normal if you did X, Y, and Z.
So that's coming up with a theoretical science based on the computational data.
Right. And then we take that and we say, okay, does it make any clinical sense? Like, for instance, they might tell me to use a drug that the adverse events could be massive. You're like, yeah, no, we're not doing that. But then we can say, what was the target? Is there another drug that would have hit that target? And then with the way they model, they can actually look in a three-dimensional way and say every single drug that hits that spot, whether we knew it did or not, they got the three-dimensional structures and they're saying, well, here's your targetable spot. Okay, now what's everything that touches that? So they'll give me a list of, say, 20 things. And the first one is always some $250,000 monoclonal that fits that spot perfectly and has a massive toxicity risk, right? I'm like, yeah, okay, that's great. It's perfect. Now, when we get to less perfect, what's going down the list? And I might have a nutraceutical on that list that's completely safe. And I'm like, okay, cool. Or there might be some pharmaceutical. Because the other thing we want to do with these types of modeling works that we're doing is not waste a lot of time getting you to health. We don't want to take some theoretical thing and have to go through 25 years of research to prove that it's safe and can be used and get the FDA. If I can find a drug that can be repurposed, that's already exists, and we know its safety record, then that's a lot faster than taking some, here's the spot, let's design a drug for that spot, which is what a pharmaceutical company would do.
Yeah. And this is what's really interesting about what you're saying about your team, because a lot of people that we have spoken to are either on the science side of working out what it is or on the treatment side of working out what could help. Whereas you're saying that you're trying to bring those two together.
Yeah, we built this institute precisely to bring those two together. And it has tremendous rewards. First, when you have a bunch of computer guys over here, men and women doing their amazing modeling stuff, that's blows my mind. And then over here in the laboratory, we got people who do assays all day long and they're amazing scientists and they're doing all this cool stuff. They never see a patient. But in our institute, right in the middle between those two people is a clinic full of patients. And what happens, it has never happened in most of these types of scientists' lives, is a patient walking up to them saying, thank you for the work you do. It matters. Wow, do you want to talk about an energized group when they can actually see the people that they're trying to help? It's not theoretic, it's real. Here are these people and they're waiting. They're sick. They need something. So the energy in our team to try to move this forward. And of course, the clinical team is not just a clinical team, it's a clinical research team that does trials as well as take care of people. So we're able to do translational science. So if I could segue to another disease that had a whole lot more money that allowed us a lot more latitude to move this kind of thinking forward, it was an illness called Gulf War illness. The men and women that went to the Gulf were exposed to a tremendous number of toxins, and one in three remain ill 30 plus years later.
Oh, wow.
The injury was a neurotoxic injury, acute neurotoxic injury. They were exposed to organophosphates, oil, all kinds of nasty things. And as it turns out, the one in three that remained ill were slow metabolizers. So they're the ones that couldn't detoxify as quick as everybody else. We figured out with lots of years of research what the risk was, why these particular people got sick. But now they're still sick.
What was the risk? Was there an underlying autoimmune condition or something like that that was just...
No. It was maybe some immunologic risk. But the big risk was actually that they couldn't get the poisons out of their system as fast as the next person. So they were exposed to a lot of things. They don't detoxify quickly, and they accumulated toxins to the point where they were damaging. And remember, these people got sarin exposed. They got organophosphates because of pesticides exposed. They were living in a cloud of oil fires that you couldn't see the whole country from a satellite for months. And that's what they were breathing and living in. So they had tremendous toxic exposures. And these same pathways that detoxify the pesticides and the sarin gas are the same pathways that detoxify oil and gas. So they had this tremendous injury, and then their brains were injured and there was neuroinflammation. So we could discern not too terribly long after they got back to their country, their states in this case, that there was a neuroinflammatory condition. And now 30 years later, we can also see that they have very similar to ME/CFS and long COVID, that their bioenergetic system has been affected. They got inflammation, they got oxidative stress, and so on and so forth. Well, in that group, which is very, very similar, but not exactly the same as long COVID or ME/CFS, we did the same thing. The modeling work, the in silico trials, the hypothesis testing. We had an animal model, which we do not have in these other diseases, to test our hypotheses. We cured a bunch of mice with our proposed interventions. And we were funded to move on to human clinical trials. So we were able to do this huge thing all the way through to human. And where we are right now is in the phase one trials in humans of the in silico projected intervention. Now, in ME/CFS, I have that same modeling all the way through to the thing I want to test. And we actually finally got some donation money, thank goodness, some money. It's just very hard to get funded in ME/CFS to do the translation piece.
Even for a team like yours with that track record,
yeah,
you are finding it difficult to get funding.
Yeah, it's getting a little more plausible that we're going to find funding, but we're talking about a decade of funding that was, I mean, let's just say in MECFS, there have been years where the whole funding pot was not more than $3 million. It's not enough to do anything. And now there's a lot more, but it's pretty well directed to the centers that were funded. And unfortunately, we weren't successful in being one of those centers. So anyway, it doesn't matter. We just keep on applying through other doors. And we also do donation efforts to try to fund some of this translation work. So anyway, in ME, I actually have enough money to start a translational study. And it's just actually now, right now, in IRB, after a long pandemic pause. And we're finally getting that game off the ground.
I think you were concerned, weren't you? Obviously, there are overlaps and some of the research that is being done will feed into ME. But I think you were concerned that the focus on long COVID might move funding even further away from ME-CFS.
Yes, there's a risk of that.
Does that mean that you think there is good funding going towards long COVID?
Well, yes, because at least in the United States, the original pot of money was this $1 billion, $1.15 billion to long COVID. I've been doing ME-CFS for more than 30 years. You couldn't add it all up and it wouldn't even come tickling close to that kind of money. It would be, I don't know, it might be $200 million over, I mean, I'm guessing, but it's about right, probably, in 30 years, you know, divide by 30. So
do you feel that funding has gone in the right direction, that $1 billion?
Oh, I don't want to stick my foot too deeply into that one.
Okay.
But they just put $500 million more to make sure the trials got done. So I will say Congress was paying attention to the advocacy voice to say, all well and good to spend all that much money on the basic science of it all, but if it doesn't move to trial, what are you doing? So there has just been a serious flush of money into the recovery network to fund the trials that they're proposing. So that's good news. I mean, that's really good news for long COVID patients, and it's good news for ME patients, because what we learned from long COVID should be very meaningful in ME. Now, what I would love to see is if they would simply add an ME-CFS control group, another sick group, to the trials. If they're going to do a trial that makes sense to do an ME-CFS, I mean, it would be silly, for instance, to use a COVID antibody in an ME-CFS patient and think that's going to do it. But it would not be silly to think that things that are looking at immune, viral reactivation, dysautonomia, all of those types of targets, all of those things could easily be used in ME-CFS patients. And it would make tremendous sense and good scientific sense to have a comparator group, a sick comparator group, when you're doing long COVID studies. So I'm trying, maybe successfully or not, but I'm trying to make the argument that as they're doing these well-funded long COVID studies, to consider using an ME-CFS control group as a sick comparator group.
So when your patients come to you, they obviously come with a great deal of hope, given the center and the work it's doing. And when you say that it's taken 30 years to get to clinical trials for the Gulf War syndrome, what are the timelines we're looking at for help with long COVID, for example?
Oh, well, that's interesting. It hasn't taken 30 years to do trials for Gulf War. It's just that we're still doing them. Actually, it's been just a lot of money for Gulf War, and there have been clinical trials going on for 20 years. There's probably 35 trials going on right now for Gulf War, because it's a well-funded area that needs solid answers. And so that's good news. So I just want to say money matters, okay, that nothing happens without the investment. And the ME-CFS patients are waiting 30 years to have clinical trials. I mean, they don't have things that you can compare to now.
People affected by the Gulf War obviously had tremendous spotlight on them. And long COVID also has a spotlight. But, you know, yeah, when you sit in our position, Emily and I, we're reaching 4 years of having long COVID now. The idea that we have to wait huge amount of time to get treatment or to have the work done. I know that medicine takes time, but
yeah. And then again, I am completely committed to, as much as one person can make a difference, to say let's expedite. But you also have to be committed to doing it right. So I'm going to say that with ME, with so little money, we have all these tiny little trials, and they're just give you hints at what we should do, but they're not definitive, and they cannot be considered evidence-based enough to to move the needle and provide guidelines for treatment that your primary care doctor could embrace and go and do. So people come to people like us because we're right on top of whatever's happening in the field, and we can try to individualize care as best we can with what we know. And maybe we know more because we lived and breathed this stuff. But it's not the same thing as having had a phase 3 clinical trial that can say 85% did this or that. So we need to move to phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials as quickly as possible. And the commitment to do that would be ideally to repurpose drugs so that you don't have to wait the 8 or 9 years to get a drug to the point where it can be used in humans. That's a long delay to try to avoid. And then as the recovery network's trying to do, build its infrastructure so that it can roll out trials and multiple trials. Think about the AIDS network for a moment, the ACTGs, AIDS clinical trials groups from back in the day, before your time, but still in my time. That was an amazing government effort that said, okay, we're going to build a network across the country. We're going to have all these clinical trials groups. We can do 10, 20, 30 trials at one time across all these things, and we're going to move the needle as fast as we can. So we discovered it was a virus in 1984. We had our first intervention, AZT, in 1987, 3 years. That was pretty impressive. By 1994, we had definitive treatments that changed everyone's lives. So it took 10 years from the discovery of the cause of the disease to having a treatment that has saved many, many, many lives. So that's a fast path.
And do you think that we are moving at a similar speed with this?
I think that the investment, at least in the United States, is such that it could be, okay, that this network that is now, I know everyone thinks, where are you? It's already been 3 years, but it takes 3 years to develop the infrastructure, to get the team up. Who knew a lot about post-viral illness 3 years ago? The ME/CFS people, and that's about it. They had to build from scratch. And then they put an enormous carrot out there. This huge amount of money had every single university. There were 220 applications from institutions, huge networks of people to be able to join that network. That was pretty wow. I mean, you put money out there, they will come. And they did. They came and brought really, really big people who are really sharp, are in this, and they're trying to get to it. So I'm going to say they're doing their thing. Meanwhile, those of us that aren't in that loop, and that includes me, but we're so focused on these post-viral illnesses, we also have our own path. We can apply independent of the network or into the network to try to move ideas forward. And so we are.
Now, one of those ideas that ties into that theory of repurposing drugs is you've done a lot of research into LDN, low dose naltrexone. Naltrexone.
Yeah.
Which is something that is of interest within the long COVID community. But that is a good example of something that you have been using with reasonable efficacy, am I right?
Absolutely.
In ME/CFS.
Yeah.
And then you are transposing that to long COVID.
We are. Yeah. We're doing a lot of different things that we learned from ME/CFS in our normal care of long COVID and then trying to develop trials. And so there is an LDN study that's underway right now. I think that Open Medicine is funding it, if I remember right. So that's exciting. But LDN is a low dose naltrexone is a very safe dosage of something called naltrexone, which people will know because it's a cousin or related to the drug that we use when we reverse an opiate overdose. So there's just a lot of experience with that drug. And they've used it a lot at high dose to treat people with addiction. But all of that gives us tons of safety data. That's very helpful. But it's not what we're using LDN for, because at the low dose, it hits a completely different space, receptor, cell in the brain than the high dose. So I'm always warning people not to read everything there is to do about addiction medicine when they learn about LDN, because it's not even talking about the right target. But it's instead affecting something called a glial cell, which is the source of a lot of inflammation in the brain. And it quiets glial cell activation, which we know to be both overactivated and driving inflammation in the brain in these complex illnesses. So LDN is a nice drug. The problem with it is that it's very personalized. You have to have a little bit of a handle on how to use it, because some people, Dr. Younger wrote the papers in fibromyalgia, if you want to dig out some papers. Jared Younger, who's an amazing guy. If you get him on your podcast, you'd enjoy it. But he did all the early work when he was at Stanford on fibromyalgia. And we have used the doses that he used because he was able to show in two back-to-back studies that were relatively small that he could reduce pain in fibromyalgia significantly. And if you look at the amount of improvement he got, it was a little bit better than the FDA-approved drugs that are out there for fibromyalgia. And it's just a much safer, easier drug to use than those drugs.
So that is something that you have been able to administer to the long COVID patients who come to your clinic with effect?
Yeah. And this is clinical experience, not a study, right? Clinical experience. We use LDN in our practice all the time, and it's going to help most people. It's not going to help everybody. And like I say, it's personalized because the dose that we pick, we start 1.5 milligrams and then move it to 3 and then to 4.5. And remember that the opiate dose is like 100. So this is very low dose.
And in a similar vein, when I was reading about it, are you using amitriptyline alongside that LDN, or is it that some of the patients received amitriptyline as well? Because that's another drug, isn't it, that is used for depression at high doses, but at low doses, it has a different effect.
It is, and it's anticholinergic. So amitriptyline is a messy, old-fashioned drug with a tremendous history. So it's been around probably 100 years. So we know a lot about it. And at low dose, it's pretty good on pain. It's pretty decent antihistamine. And it's anticholinergic. So if you think about people with dysautonomia, that they're sort of cholinergically in hyperdrive. And so this counters some of that as well. Flip side, you can't use tricyclics forever because they have some risk, maybe too much to say based on the data that's out there. But I worry enough about using tricyclics for a long time because this might increase the risk for dementias or cognitive defects as you get older. So I'll use them sometimes just to get everything under control for a while. And a while might even be a few years, but I try not to get into a lifelong dosage of something like that. And LDN doesn't have as widespread a use. It's interesting about these drugs where you worry about risk for this or that as you get older, because the way they're getting at that literature now is because you can dig into the entire electronic medical record of the national health system, for instance, and you can say, well, look, this drug is associated with that. So in France, they did a study and said that the diagnosis of asthma was considered protective for neurodegenerative illness. Well, it turned out it wasn't the disease. It was the drug they were using to treat the disease, the puffers that were hitting a neuroprotective spot in the brain and protecting. So when you say anticholinergics might not be good for you long-term, it could be the drug, but it could be the disease associated with drug or some other drug you also use when you use this drug.
Some of the drugs might actually have positive side effects.
Yeah, and some drugs do, like the puffers for asthma. Apparently that's a good idea. So that's interesting.
Are there other drugs that you have used clinically in the treatment of long COVID that you have repurposed with good effect? Because there was a lot of talk here in the early days of antihistamines and...
Oh, there's so much important space. And we do have our own blog. It's called Hope and Help for Fatigue and Chronic Illness. We just released it in January. We're in the top 2% internationally of all the podcasts. It's pretty exciting.
Wow. So
we busted up into pieces. Isn't that something? It's really cool because we've gotten these real foremost authorities and we say, you know, in 10 to 20 minutes, you need to tell us, how do you treat this aspect or that aspect of long COVID or ME/CFS? So we've had some amazing people. Anyway, that brings me to what do? I busted up into its pieces. Okay. So if you want to talk about, say, antihistamines, we're talking about mast cells. Mast cells are your allergy cells. They're also the lineage cell for those glial cells I was talking about. Similar drugs affect them. And mast cell activation is a major player in these illnesses and why you feel chronically lousy, because this overactivated immune system is driving a lot of things, including your mast cells, to degranulate and release a lot of nasty stuff. So if you can keep them from doing that, if you're not just mopping up the mess they're making, but actually stabilizing the cell and keeping it from releasing things, that's a good thing. We have a bunch of podcasts on this, but our authority and our team is Theo Harris, Theo Herardis, who's I think he's got his own website called mastcellmaster.com. He's great. He's really a great, clever guy. But he's done some really amazing podcasts in our little series of podcasts about how to stabilize cells. I talk about it's an onion and you're peeling layers of the onion. I'm an immunologist. You think the very first thing I would do when I see a patient is take care of their immune system? It's not true. I can't make their immune system better until I've taken care of some other things first. So one of the things I take care of, very first thing I take care of, is oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is a great big player, and it's part of the reason why energy levels are so poor.
And the reason for PEM, is it? For post-exertional malaise?
Yeah, it does drive the PEM, because your cells are not making energy efficiently, and they're not mopping up the mess that energy makes efficiently. And if you drive too many, the mess, the free radicals that you don't mop up, it'll actually pop a cell open and kill it, or at least drive it down to not function any further. So having enough of the stuff that mops up the free radicals is actually a critical player in trying to help people feel better. And it's not so straightforward. It's not here, have this magic formula of antioxidants, it's going to work. Because you need some stuff. You need it to go across the blood-brain barrier. Whoa, that's a big thing. You know, what crosses the blood-brain barrier? Not everything that you pop in your mouth is a nutraceutical, but crosses the blood-brain barrier. So that matters. Then there are things that play more than one role. So I talk about oxidative stress and I talk about mast cells. Some of the things that stabilize mast cells are powerful antioxidants. So that's a twofer, right? You don't have to take as many drugs if you get a twofer. So like quercetin, which is a terrific mast cell stabilizer, is a terrific antioxidant. Luteolin, a terrific mast cell stabilizer, that is also crosses the blood-brain barrier and is an amazing antioxidant. But one of the other antioxidants that's a big player is NAC, N-acetylcysteine. I don't know if you can get that in England.
Yeah, I just bought it.
Oh, you did. Excellent. Thank you. Because it was controversial here, but now it's available again over the counter. But for a while, they tried to pull it because of some FDA thing, but it's now resolved. Yay. But there's a neat study by Dr. Shungu, Dacoma Shungu, that showed that NAC in ME/CFS patients and in Gulf War illness patients crosses the blood-brain barrier and reverses to normal the imaging of oxidative stress in the brain. That's crazy cool. There's somebody that showed me with visual images that you can cross something into the brain and make something normal again. So we have all kinds of data that there's oxidative stress in the brain in ME/CFS and growing literature in long COVID using the same kind of technology. But then here's an intervention that he's now funded to do a trial, a dose finding study. But I'm excited that he has this data set that he's been sharing that shows he got something to cross. So I start with antioxidants in my practice, because if I don't at least do that, why would anything else work? If you can't make the cells begin to work, then anything you do to jig them into action could make everything a lot worse. If the cells hunker down, because if it did anything more, it would die. Don't try to make it do more. Fix why it's hunkered down. The point is that if you could correct as much as you can that would allow a cell to function normally, then you can try to make it work harder. So that's the immune system. So then here comes the immune system. What are we doing for it? Well, it's inflammatory. It's overactivated. And it's basically in hyperdrive. One of the 10 commandments of immunology is the immune system is antigen driven. It doesn't just turn on because it wants to. It's turned on because something pushed the on button. Okay. And the other thing about the immune system is there are only a few things to push a lot of different on buttons. Usually the immune system is just cleaning up the infection that's on board. Right? You got the flu, the cells that clean up the flu turn on, you clean up the flu, and then there's a whole system to turn it back off again, right? But in the immune system, if everything's turned on, which this is a very overactivated, but in a polyclonal, so everything's turned on kind of way, there are only a few things that do that. One is Epstein-Barr virus.
On your quercetin NAC, just a quick thing. I mean, if you tell your listeners, are these things that people can buy just over the counter or?
Over the counter. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're usually in allergy combinations or individually. There's a lot of different products. This one's called D-HIST, like histamine, D-I-H-I-S-T. One of my favorites are the ones that Dr. Thea Herardi's tried to help to formulate. One that's called Neuroprotect. That's a good one. The Luteolin you can buy straight up from that company as well. That they're formulated specifically for mast cell stabilizing things, but they are powerful antioxidants at the same time that cross the blood-brain barrier. So for me, it's all about getting stuff to the brain. Not that your body doesn't matter. Your body does, but anything that gets in your brain is also all in your body. So it's the brain that's the hard target, right?
Have you seen mast cells being prevalent in the majority of your patients? A mast cell issue?
Yeah, it's a very, very common, if not to the point where you can diagnose the actual condition, mast cell activation, which is hard to diagnose because you have to catch them in the moment in time when they're releasing histamine. It's a very brief
thing. And most people here don't understand this
at all. Yeah, it's really tricky to diagnose. So when you find it and you can diagnose it, yay. But if the blood tests are negative and the patient looks like and responds to mast cell treatments, then treat them. That's my belief is make them better.
Yeah, so it's so interesting. So the NHS here, they'll just send you for the, what is it, IgG? Testing against specific allergens. Noreen and I have both been so allergic, or we've both had that allergic reaction to so many different things. And if I have testing here, they say, no, you're fine. I can't even get an appointment in an allergy clinic, let alone start dealing with the mast cell activation.
Yeah, I'm going to clue you onto another website. It's called MECFSClinicianscoalition.org. That is a group of international physicians with a lot of experience in ME/CFS who got together and tried to write some helpful things for doctors to follow when they're trying to take care of ME patients. And there's a really good description of how to treat mast cell disorders in ME.
Fabulous.
It's a very nice spot to go. Honestly, when you get a group of people together with many, many hundreds of years of experience combined, and you say, okay, what's been the thing that helps your patients the most? One of the things we all agreed on was treating mast cell disorders. Mast cells really matter.
That's the same in ME/CFS as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the other thing with mast cells is that you don't have to have a positive allergy test to have a mast cell disorder. That's really important.
I understand that.
We understand.
I mean, they can release with cold and with heat and with stress and with, you know.
Yeah, with stress particularly. But yeah, I understand that. But the clinical directive here does not understand it.
I get that. I know you guys are dealing with some serious guideline-focused stuff in the UK.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about your work on CD8 T cell dysfunction?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Because that's a very recent paper, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's with Lisa Sellen, who's a really excellent T cell immunologist, if you would, the University of Massachusetts. She's really excellent. But and her work is valid. There's other groups that are seeing the same thing she has at the recent ME/CFS conference at the NIH in December. There was quite a bit on this. But the bottom line is that chronic immune activation is not good for your immune system. Let's just say that. And what it does is it wears it out. The word of T cell exhaustion rings true with people with fatiguing illnesses, but we're talking about not fatigued, but exhausted, meaning they've depleted all the stuff they need inside that does the hard work of clearing viruses. So T cells, cytotoxic T cells and natural killer cells, their job is to run around surveying for old viruses and keeping them from popping out, as well as helping clear things that are going on right now. And if they are just constantly on guard, constantly doing that job, they use up the perforins and granzymes that they have inside that do the hard work. And they shift to a sort of an early aging phenotype that looks like the immune system of, say, an 80-year-old and a 40-year-old, an older, more depleted immune system that can't jazz up and activate and go, 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 go.
Your study that saw this in ME/CFS and long COVID patients, is that right?
That's exactly right, yeah. That's definitely true. And then the other thing that's happening immunologically, when that happens, is viruses reactivate. So if you go back to long COVID, there's this really important observation that's in now multiple papers that says, what are the risk factors from acute COVID that make someone more likely to have long COVID? And one of them is that if Epstein-Barr virus reactivates during acute COVID, you're more likely to have long COVID. And then a separate study that said, if Epstein-Barr virus is reactivated, you're more likely to see that in long COVID patients than recovered patients. So one of those observations is at the time of acute infection, EBV reactivates. And the other is 3 months later, 6 months later, if you have long COVID, if you get compared to people who have recovered, you're more likely to have Epstein-Barr virus reactivated. Okay. So now we bring up the ugly head of what is the role of viral reactivation in these diseases. Back to ME/CFS, we also see these viruses reactivated. And while long COVID hasn't had as much work in viral reactivation as ME/CFS has had, in ME/CFS, we see the herpes family viruses in general, and EBV is a herpes family virus, but HHV6, CMV, but the big one, HHV6. HHV6 is the most common reactivated virus in ME patients. And there hasn't been much focus on that yet in long COVID. And then there's another virus that's got nothing to do with herpes family viruses. It's Coxsackie virus. It's an enterovirus, and it reactivates in the gut. So this is the work of John Chia in ME/CFS, and it's a protected compartment. You can't see it in the blood. You actually have to have a biopsy of the stomach or the intestine to look for that viral reactivation. In John's work, which is extensive with many hundreds of patients, he showed, and I'm guessing but not too far off the numbers, when he looked at people who had endoscopy for, say, GERD, for reflux, and he used the GERD as controls in the ME/CFS patients or the treated group, 80% of ME patients had reactivated enterovirus and 20% of the GERD controls. So that's a very significant difference. I mean, that's very big. And then he's done a lot of work since then to prove it.
And that's something that's not being picked up on any blood tests.
Right. So we all focused on just one virus because it's the one they looked for, Epstein-Barr. But you got when the immune system is not behaving well and it's letting viruses out, it's going to let out the viruses that are latent, whatever your viruses are. Now, the most common of those will always be HHV6 because practically everybody, something like 99% of adults has HHV6 virus. Same thing with EBV. I think it's 98 or 97% have had acute EBV at some point. So these are very, very common. But enteroviruses are also common. So it complicates the picture of how do you treat, because the antivirals you would use for herpes family viruses are not the same as the ones you use for enteroviruses. And so it just becomes a little more dicey. We really don't have good treatments for enteroviruses.
Do we have good treatments for herpes viruses,
though? Well, not really, but they're better than, you know. So we have acyclovir is the generic common one that is easy to get, ganciclovir. But there's another drug called valganciclovir. That one is toxic and hard to use. And we use it like in patients that have life-threatening viral reactivation when they have chemotherapy and things like that. But there has been a clinical trial with that more potent, more toxic, more efficacious, but more scary antiviral in ME/CFS. But Stanford did a study, Dr. Montoya, and he was able to show that the people who responded to that therapy were people that had high antibody titers for EBV that were suggestive of viral reactivation. So he gave us some of the information we feel better about using when we're looking at our patient's serology and saying, are you reactivated or aren't you?
So reactivation aside, in terms of potential virus remaining in the system with COVID, you have tried monoclonal antibodies. Am I right in thinking, in three patients, alleviating the COVID virus?
Yeah, so let's do talk about that study. So a colleague of mine, Dr. Pepe, who's the real guy that thought to do that, not me, he just came to me because he was so excited about what he saw. And then we put our heads together and wrote the next thing. But he did a series of patients with a monoclonal antibody to long COVID. He used, in this case, that was Regeneron, was the monoclonal that he used, in patients who had Delta or before. So these are people that were infected like a year and a half ago or longer. He was so excited. He called me. He said, oh my gosh, these people, they're getting better. And he had this first series. Now he's got a series of, I think he told me, 18-ish patients that he feels that he has been able to change their lives. So And I mean, if you saw those case series, they were better. They weren't just.
You say that so.
Remission in a week. It's.
Yeah, it was remarkable. So if you go to the literature and say, okay, why would that happen? There's also these little small studies that look for COVID persistence. So here's the brain bang on this one, right? Which is COVID is supposed to be a virus like a cold virus. It's in the same family, coronaviruses, that are cold viruses. They come, they go, they come, they go. They don't stick around. They're not latent and they're not persistent, right? Latent means they go inside a cell and they hang out. And persistent means it never cleared them. Like hepatitis C or B would be a persistent virus, right? And Epstein-Barr would be a latent virus, something that went underground and you don't see it again unless your immune system takes a hit. So now we have this data to say people have found at least COVID antigen, which is what you see when you do PCR, but some other data to say, yeah, there's a whole virus that's replicating in people that are sick 3 or 6 months, and now maybe one paper that says a year out. So no one's really looked at you folks that are from 2020, 2021 in enough case series to say, is it there or not? But here comes Dr. Pepe, who treats some people with long-term COVID with a virus variant that was sensitive to the monoclonal that he used, right? Remember, the variants keep changing, and these monoclonals don't work on the current variant, so much so that they've been pulled from the market. So these variants, Delta, Alpha, Beta variants, these monoclonals that were developed earlier in the pandemic game worked well on those. So here he is. He's got this case series for the three that we reported and some more since then. It did the trick. You want to hear my long story that follows this? I'm so sorry to say this, but it's work. I mean, I will do this study. But it is not easy to do this study because the state of Florida is very excited. Dr. Pepe called the Department of Health, and Ken Shepke, who's the first author of that paper, got excited too. And we wrote this paper. And then they found some money to allow me to do a phase 1 study, an open label phase 1 study with another 20 people. Now, here is the problem. Those drugs were pulled from the market. Regeneron is expired. There's no current active bottle of Regeneron that you could legitimately give to a patient. The Glaxo product expires in about 3 weeks, but the Lilly product, it's good until August. So I am going to do a Lilly product study because that's the drug I'm allowed to use without having them make me new stuff.
Which is effective on that same early strain.
Yeah, it's effective. And in fact, it even catches the early Omicron. So
do you want Noreen and I to come and take part in your trial?
So you can podcast me. Yeah, I've got a lot of volunteers.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, my process, I have to have an FDA IND, which is in process, and then it goes to the IRB, which is quick. But this FDA IND is a process. Right now, I'm in that process. I am anticipating that I will be infusing patients. I had hoped by now, because honestly, I got the funding in the beginning of February, 6 weeks ago. And so I thought I could roll through quickly in my optimistic rose-colored glasses kind of way of thinking. And it turns out, yeah, ha, 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 that was funny. But we'll get there. If nothing else, I'm a persistent bugger. So I'll get it through and I'll be treating people when I can treat them. And if the earliest I could hope to treat them would be end of April, early May. That's probably where I'm really at in terms of starting this study. But then it's quick study, you know, because you only do 2 infusions. They're quick.
And they're ready in a week. The people are done.
You can line them all up and they'll be just lined outside the door. Get the number 20, go, oh, sorry, stop.
Is this an expensive treatment?
No, not right now, because essentially this drug is going to get thrown away. I don't have to pay for the drug in this study. And, you know, I don't know what the expense of this drug was during the pandemic, because the country underwrote everything, right? Everyone got this treatment for free, which is unusual here. Very weird, but not weird where you are, but weird where we are.
Yeah. If it's effective, then someone would have to remake the drug.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, if it's effective, won't they want to, you know? So that's just it. So, yeah, we're in communication with all of the companies that made monoclonals. And they're waiting for me to get a publishable 20. So I think that when we have that. The state of Florida is very enthusiastic about this, and they're helping make connections that even if it's not funded by pharma, could perhaps be funded by private foundation.
I think we should all be quite excited about that. I do think that these people are amazingly placed the way that they've turned their attention to long COVID. And the technology that they're doing this with, I just thought was really fascinating. What did you think?
I agree. She's this powerhouse of knowledge, but really, I would have loved for her to have been my headmistress at school. Do you know what I mean? She just gives off that great no-nonsense vibe. Or not even my headmistress. Please be the headmistress of my daughter's school. Right?
Yeah. Because she gives you a sort of faith in her, but not because she's trying to sort of bamboozle you with
the science.
With the science, with her amazing. She's just so
solid, right?
Yeah. I want to go and see her.
We say that about everybody, though.
Do you think we're just starstruck by these doctors? Because everyone that we speak to, and obviously we source these people, we do our research, we have the scientific papers backing it up, or sometimes it's anecdotal evidence, but we do build a bank of evidence before we approach these people to talk to them. Do you think that we then just get starstruck by the ones that we think actually have some weight in terms of their treatment of long COVID patients?
Maybe, but I don't think we're easily starstruck. And there have been people that we've interviewed that we haven't aired in the past.
That's true.
Because it didn't fit with what we were looking for, or it didn't fit with the, what's the right word here?
Our ethos?
Yes. And it didn't pass the smell test, some of it.
Yeah. So people that we don't necessarily agree 100% with, we have certainly aired because we have wanted to have that discussion on air. It has often been more to do with the people that we feel either are talking bullshit or the people that are actually pretty condescending towards chronic illness sufferers.
Yeah, so there is a lot of due diligence in our work.
Yeah, and this team at Nova Southeastern University have definitely passed our due diligence tests.
We should have one of those get-togethers, you know, that people have, where we'll just put it out there and people in the area who listen to us can come and meet us.
Should we do that? A lunchtime thing in central London or somewhere in London. And we'll just say, we're going to be in this cafe. Let's not make it inaccessible. Come and meet us and meet other long COVID-y people.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good idea. You know that I love my mindfulness group still. I still go to my mindfulness group and it's online. But just being with other long COVID-y people, I find really reassuring sometimes.
Yeah, we should do it.
Let's do it. If people would like to come, let's do it.
Let us know in the comments if you think this is a good idea and we can arrange it. Unfortunately, we're in London, so it has to be London people.
Yeah. Sorry to be capital centric. Yeah. But that's where we live. It's a great idea, Noreen.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.